call the meeting of the Health Committee to order. We'll pick up where we left off last week, and we had a motion, so I'll just renew my motion that House File 227 be recommended pass. And Representative Blaine, where was the referral from here?
Mr. Chair,
say in here is for possible inclusion.
Okay,
I'll modify my motion. Just renew my motion that House File 227 be considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. And I think we had explanation of the bill. We had testimony pro and con. So I believe we're at a point where we can open up for members' questions and or debate or discussion. Representative Huffman?
Mr. Chair, Blaine, I asked a few questions about who would be eligible given the language of this bill. Currently, most of the hospitals, probably not any of the Catholic hospitals, but most of the hospitals in the state currently perform abortions on fetuses that basically don't have a brain. They're called anencephalic fetuses. That's not done to save the life of the mother. The mother's life is not in danger because of that kind of a pregnancy. Another common one would be Tay-Sachs disease. Children are not going to survive after they're born for very long, and in most of the hospitals in the state, those kinds of pregnancies would be terminated. In addition to that, if a woman's been raped or is pregnant due to incest, again, most hospitals in the state will abort those children. Would that prevent them from being participating then in any of the family planning grants according to what's in this bill?
Ms. Rowley, you wanted to answer that?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, yes, it would. And a short answer, I won't beat around the bush. We believe that those lives that you were talking about do have value, and that those are abortions. And as far as I know, also, I don't know that a lot of the hospitals are actually applying for family planning grant money. So I don't know that it would necessarily affect them.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Ocumba?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Blaine. In the BOC grant, sometimes the WIC program is included. Would that program be jeopardized by this particular bill?
Ms. Rao?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ocumba, you said the BOC grants, are you speaking of the Maternal and Child Health BOC grants?
Representative Kemba? I think Representative Kemba is speaking to the WIC money. I believe this bill only deals with family planning grants. I don't know if that helps to know what the question is.
Right. Mr. Chairman, Representative Kemba, it does deal with family planning grants. We do state that maternal and child health grants are included, and so if WIC was rolled up into one grant with all of that, then yes, it would be affected.
Representative
Mr. Chair, that is the case, and so that isn't just family planning grants. I'm all for the family planning grants, but WIC and some of those programs that are rolled into the BOC grants are actually preventing abortions. So I don't know if there's a way to draft an amendment or something to make sure some of those programs go on.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Ocumba, obviously it's not our intent to specifically single out any WIC money. That's obviously a program that is good and obviously not involved with abortion. I'm not sure how much that would be affected anyway, that the entities that would be applying for the WIC money through the grant program, that they would be involved with abortion and therefore be ineligible. So I'm not sure if it would directly affect any organization specifically.
Representative Thiessen.
Yes.
I'm sorry, just to walk to that point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Giesen. Just to follow up with Representative Otrembo's point around WIC, I'm wondering if that can help me, because that was a modification that we did 2 years ago in changing some of the block grants, and now what is in there besides the WIC and family planning?
Who's your question directed to?
I'm looking around.
Good. Sorry, I don't have the answer.
The reason why I bring that up is back to what Ms. Rose said and the intent of it, because there are other. There's the health disparity dollars, I know for sure, that are in there, some of their dollars and some of the other things, and not being clear, especially around the organizations that traditionally have received the dollars, and if your intent is really to focus on family planning. Following up with what Representative Otrembo said, I'm wondering if we should be looking at language to really get to your point instead of making sure that there aren't adverse consequences for some of these other grants and organizations.
Well, first of all, let's make sure, Ms. Rao, that I've heard your answers correctly. I think most of us were pretty heavily focused on the family planning grant funds, and we all understand where we are in that regard. I think the question that gets raised is to what extent does this go over into the maternal block grants? Is that sort of the question? And if I heard your answer, as it currently stands in the bill, I think you said that it would affect it. Did I understand that correctly?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct.
Okay. Now, let me ask then sort of an extension to Representative Walker's question and perhaps, as we hinted by Representative Otrembo, are you open to a remedy? You said you weren't, for example, intending to go after the WIC. If we were able to get some help, maybe from the Department of Health or somebody that could help us look at this language, would you be open to a remedy to this?
Mr. Chairman, we would be willing to. I'm not sure exactly how the Maternal and Child Health Block Grant is structured. If within that grant there are kind of subcategories for WIC or the health disparities programs and such, or if it really is just a single block amount where the counties or other entities can use it in any way. Our intention is to get at the money that is being used for family planning. And so we would hope to do that, because I know that some of the purpose of the Maternal and Child Health Block Grant is for family planning purposes.
Well, I do want to move this bill on and hold it over. It will give us some time, and it'll come back to us if we decide to in our omnibus bill. I do think that a legitimate issue has been raised, and that with maybe some help, we could probably call somebody from the health department, but I don't want to sit here as a committee and sort of redesign the bill. I think if the issue has been articulated clearly enough, and perhaps we can get some help from the Department of Health, and I think that even the Public Health Nurses Organization is as well interested, the local public health groups are. If we can have a good faith intention here to try to deal with it, and I think there'll be at least a couple of us watchful. I just don't know that we can sit here and redesign it right now.
Mr. Chair and members, and Representative Otrembo and Representative Walker, I think you do bring a valid issue to this bill, and I think it is an issue that's worth seeking some more counsel on. With the chair's indulgence to be able to act on the bill, I would give you and Representative Walker my commitment that I will continue to investigate this and would be more than happy to work with both you, Representative Otrembo, and Representative Walker, that we can come to a satisfactory conclusion. I do believe you understand and would be supportive of what we're trying to do with House File 227, but on the same token too, we don't want to be adversely affecting a group that we also feel is doing positive work out there.
Well, this group will have another opportunity to deal with the language as it comes back in our omnibus bill, and we have some latitude to amend it in more than one way. But I think it would be important, and we have at least a couple of people here, I think, who would like to be parties to whatever the conclusion before that time, so that when we do come back, we've brought this matter to conclusion. So if we can leave it that for now, with a commitment to follow up, then we'll proceed on to other discussion. Further discussion, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two kind of quick questions, I hope. The first is, I have some concerns about the provision here that talks about public advocacy. And I know that, I think that there's some case law out there on that you can pick and choose kind of in terms of what kind of information you can pass between doctor and patient. But this goes beyond that and starts saying that people can't be engaged in the public process of either coming to the legislature kind of core First Amendment rights. And I'm just wondering if you're aware of any of the constitutional ramifications of going down the path of taking, I think, it's a step further than we've seen before, and actually kind of content-based choices regarding what you can talk about in a purely political process kind of the First Amendment.
But, Jason, could you give us the reference in the bill?
I'm looking at the definition, Mr. Chair, definition of public advocacy on page 2, line 10. Going on, it's subdivision or F there. And then, I think that goes, as I understand it, goes farther than we've seen in some of the case law. And so I just was wondering if you'd looked at that issue.
Ms. Rao, you'll speak to that?
Sure. Chairman Bradley and Representative Thiessen, I'm not sure if there have actually been cases on this specific at this point. When we initially drafted this legislation several years ago now, there were two states that were either in the process of or working on having legislation like this, and that was in Missouri and Michigan at the time. And so this legislation is really kind of a combination of what they were working on in those two states. And I would like to state, though, that we don't believe that this is infringing on anybody's First Amendment rights. We aren't saying that people cannot speak or cannot do things. We're simply asking them to choose, because we do believe that it's government has a very legitimate purpose in deciding when and where and how the taxpayer dollars are spent. And we do strongly believe that a majority of Minnesotans believe that abortion is not right and don't want their money going to organizations that are supporting or encouraging abortion. And so we're merely asking those organizations to choose whether or not they want to receive the taxpayer funding or whether or not they want to engage in those activities.
Mr. Chair, I understand that position. It just strikes me that also if you're picking and choosing on who gets taxpayer dollars based on a political belief in some sense and what you can say about politics, I do think that there are First Amendment concerns raised by that. And so I guess I'll just leave that comment with that. And I forgot my other question. So
good. Must be we're done.
Good for everybody. Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Blaine, also that phrase one, regularly engaging in efforts to encourage passage or defeat of legislation pertaining to so on. Does that mean if somebody came here and testified twice before this committee opposed to a bill like this, that that organization that they represented could never get family planning money again?
Ms. Rao?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Huntley, I think that may be up to the courts or the department if they were granting the money to determine exactly what regularly means.
Well, Mr. Chair, it seems to me we ought to know what the legal implications of what we pass is going to have, and it's not our job to pass bills that are going to end up in court. It's our job to pass bills that won't end up in court.
Further discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Kristen Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question, and I don't believe you can, and so I'm hoping someone from the department can answer this for me. Let me first ask, under the current language in this bill, are you aware, this would be for you, Ms. Rowe, are you aware of any clinics that would qualify for the family planning grants?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Walker, I don't know what specific clinics do and do not do relating to abortion, so I can't, I don't know for sure what any of the clinics do for the most part.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I would like some further information from the department as it relates to what clinics do. Do clinics have the full array of different things and not in general, making sure that there's a wide variety from rural, urban, and suburban. But my other question that I know you can't answer is another department question. Under the current awardees of the 04 and 05 family planning grants, I'm interested in knowing which one of these organizations would qualify if this language was put on. And I realize there may be different organizations out there that haven't applied in the past that may apply, but I'm still interested in knowing, out of all of these groups and clinics and organizations and others, who would still qualify. And Mr. Chair, I do that because looking at this, many of these are clinics.
Is there someone from the department that might be able to give us a shot at an answer now? Good evening. You can begin by introducing yourself for the record, please.
My name is Carol Wolverton. I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Health, oversight of the Bureau of Community and Family Health Protection. And if you could repeat, Representative Walker, your first question for me.
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My first question was, and I don't know if you'll have the answer, as it relates to the clinics. And would clinics qualify for these family planning grants under this current language? If you don't know that particular answer, I'm looking for an answer as it relates to, do clinics, is there a clinic that does not do some form of referral in some type of kind related to abortion?
Ms. Wolverton?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, clinics vary so much across the board as to what they do and what they don't do and who they're affiliated with and who they're not affiliated with. I think as I read through this particular bill, they would have to present to the department an audit of their last fiscal audit showing what their affiliations are, and that would be a portion of the determination according to this bill that would say whether they qualify or they don't qualify for the dollars.
Mr. Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't know if I agree with that piece of it, and I don't think you can answer my question, and so I don't, and there must not be someone here from the department that can. So if you'd be kind enough to find out who can answer that question, because you're right, clinics do vary. But when it comes to not providing, but just if I pick up the phone and ask for a referral, what clinics don't provide that, if we have any in the state of Minnesota? And my second question was, out of all of the, and you probably won't be able to answer this piece of it tonight, and I'm okay with that too, since we have some time. Out of all of the organizations and clinics and others that have been funded in the 04-05 cycle, which one of these would still qualify under this language?
Ms. Wolverton?
Mr. Chair and Representative Walker, in going over the list that I have in front of me of those that were given dollars for the FPSP grants during the 04-05 cycle, I guess that would be tough to know, looking at this, who qualifies and who doesn't.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Walker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I can find that out.
I'll post that. That would be helpful. I think that while this bill is moving along, I think it's going to be helpful not just for myself but the public to know. And I don't believe it's to the intent of the author or advocacy organizations to be limiting opportunities for clinics in general. Ms. Rowe commented earlier about hospitals. And most hospitals probably aren't going to be seeking this, but we do have a wide variety of clinics throughout the state that do try to help out in family planning.
Thank you. I guess there's a couple of follow-ups then, Ms. Wolderton, if you don't mind a follow-up. We're a discussion. Let's end Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, just to give my final, you know, at the same time that we have a bill that I think has good intentions called Positive Alternatives, and I support the, in theory, the need to help women that want to take their pregnancy to term and deliver the child. I think they need help. But at the same time, we're hearing on that bill, I want to review some of the things we've heard in the last 3 years. A continual approach to push abstinence-only education rather than comprehensive education, when it's quite clear from scientific peer-reviewed journals that comprehensive education, sex education, works, and abstinence-only does not work. Pregnancy rate and the abstinence-only programs and the STDs in those groups were higher than those groups that got comprehensive sex education. 3 years ago, the House proposed to cut family planning money by 50%. I think they ended up with only about a 20% cut, but your proposal was to cut family planning by 50%. This bill today attempts to remove family planning money from groups that know how to do it and have had a very effective, cost-effective way of delivering family planning to a large number of young women in this state. And I want to remind you that for a lot of these young women, 18 to 25, they're working, they're starting their careers, they don't have health insurance, and for the healthy ones, if they go to Planned Parenthood or another family planning clinic, they get their entire health care for the year for around $400. They get all the exams they need, and they're told if they're healthy. And if they're not healthy, well, then they got a problem with not having insurance. But I don't know where else we can get somebody complete health care for $400 a year. The governor's budget proposal this year, it attempts to kick unmarried young women off of Minnesota care, deny them health care. Representative Wilkin has a bill to remove the state mandate that health insurance must cover maternity. It's very ironic. At the same time, we have bills like Positive Alternatives. We have bills that want to deny young women maternity coverage. This is a continual attack by the right wing on young women in this state that are trying to start their careers, and I don't know why we don't help them instead of trying to punish them for being women.
Listen, listen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Excuse me. First of all, I want to thank Representative Blaine for bringing this forward, and also thank you, Representative Blaine, for your openness tonight to offer members from both sides of the aisle to work with them in the future on the process of this bill. I just want to point out a couple of quick points, and then I'll conclude with some questions that I don't expect to be answered tonight, but just in the process. I just want to bring back the focus on this is a grant program. If you apply for this program, you know what the criteria is or will be. To me, it seems pretty simple that if you provide abortions, you know under this definition or criteria of this grant that you wouldn't be eligible. There's an easy way to become eligible, and that's A, stop providing the abortions or stop referring the abortions. Simple as that. We have a lot of different grant programs throughout the state, and we have criteria, and I think that's our job is to establish that criteria for the different grants, i.e. tax dollars that you and I and our constituents pay. So it's just accountability of tax dollars. The two questions I guess I would have just And I probably have this, but if the department could get this in the next few days, just I think Ms. Wolverton referenced the list of all those that received the family planning grants. If I could get a copy of that, and then also I will work with the committee staff probably, but I think it'd be important for us just to keep in reference the total dollar amount per biennium that goes to family planning grants, and that would help me in the future discussion of this bill. But again, thank you, Representative Blaine, for your hard work in bringing this issue forward.
maybe just a sort of a fundamental, and I'm sort of happy really that our discussion went around to one area which I think is an unintended consequence that we'll come back to. But on the fundamental issue, it seems to me that everywhere I go, whatever people's view are of pro-life, pro-choice, whatever it may be, one of the things that there seems to be unanimous agreement is that abortion is not a family planning tool. And it seems to me that fundamentally what this is about is acknowledging that truth. And why would you therefore provide family planning grants to an organization that is connected to abortion? I mean, that's sort of what the fundamental. Now, I realize that it gets a little more technical than that, but to me, that's really the heart of the issue here, is that abortion is not a family planning tool, and I think people on all sides of the issue have always agreed with that. I see no further discussions. I know that Representative Engel wanted to have a chance to get here to be able to vote on this, and I think because this is a more controversial issue, members should have the opportunity to vote on it. So I think I want to proceed, though, that we should proceed to vote. I'll renew my motion that House File 220...
Let's have a roll call.
No one's requested a roll call.
We request a roll call.
Roll call has been requested. Roll call be taken. The motion before us that we'll be voting on is a motion to hold this, hold House File 227 over with the possible inclusion in the omnibus finance bill. Call the roll.
Bradley?
Yes.
Hempstead?
Yes.
Abler?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Eakin?
Yes.
Hammer? Goodwin? Huntley?
No.
Otremba?
Yes.
Pepin?
Yes.
Powell?
Yes.
Samuelson?
Yes.
Tao? Beeson?
No.
Walker?
Yes.
Wilkins?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 3 nays, motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Blatt.
Thank you, Chairman Bradley.
That's him, welcome. Some welcome, whoops. Representative Wilkin, welcome to the committee. Would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move that House File 1921 be recommended to pass and re-referred to, sure where it's going next. I think to the General Register.
Representative Wilkin, move House File 1921 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Representative Wilkin, to your bill.
Mr. Chairman, the committee is going to get a rare treat today because my folder with the notes for my presentation sitting in my office, so you can get the abbreviated version of me, from me, but a little bit more meat from the testifiers, which is I found the testimony for those members who were on the committee last year. There's some very powerful testimony on this bill. But what we're doing is we're making changes to the minor consent for medical treatment, the statute that was passed in the early 70s. In that, minors are allowed to consent for their own health care without their parents, permission or consent on areas of pregnancy, STDs, chemical dependency, and family planning. And what this seeks to do is to put the parents back into the formula so that they're part of the children's decision-making process but it also allows this, we're basically where we're starting is where we left off last year as the bill left the floor. There are several amendments that were put on this bill along the process in this committee and on the floor that I believe that made this bill a better bill. There are several exceptions to what I'm planning here for getting the parents involved. One of them is allowing parents to contract with providers to, if that parent chooses, if they say my child is mature enough, if just according to their values they think that they'd like their child to be able to discuss things with their provider and not involve the parent, they can do that by entering into a contract with that provider. Other exceptions are, there's an exception here for minors and out-of-home placements. That was an issue that was brought up that we addressed through an amendment. Specifically, there was a situation with children who were runaways or abandoned youth that were in out-of-home placements that are licensed by the state. They would be able to provide some of these services and consent for that child. Also, there's an exception for organizations receiving Title X funding. But I think the most compelling thing is, since this law was first passed in the early 70s, none of the factors have improved. Teen pregnancy haven't improved. STDs haven't improved. Chemical dependency has not improved. None of those factors went the right direction. So taking parents out of the equation and out of the children's lives did not have the intended effect. It did not improve things. The advocates of the law will come here and tell us that they have studies that show that children will not receive, they will forego treatment if this bill passes. What they're relying on is surveys, public opinion surveys essentially, that show that teens are nervous about talking to their parents. And that's not a news flash. I was nervous about talking to my parents about some things too, but the fact that I needed to as a youth kept me going in the right direction. And what they don't have and cannot show you is actual studies of actual behavior supporting their position. So, Mr. Chairman, rather than take up more time, I'd like to, if we could get to the testimony in favor of this bill.
Mr. Chair, can I just have a quick follow-up on that? Just in terms of studies, is there studies of actual behavior showing the opposite?
Mr. Chairman, yes, there is a study. It's an Israeli study, and I believe Professor Collette can speak to that more directly.
Okay, you want to call the following people, or you want me to follow the order that's on here?
Let me just follow the order.
Okay. I think our first name is Teresa Collette.
Mm-hmm.
Good evening. Welcome to the committee. If you'd please reintroduce yourself, and then I'll make sure that I pronounce it correctly.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Teresa Collette. I'm a professor of law at the University of St. Thomas School of Law. However, my appearance tonight is in my personal capacity, and it does not in any way represent the views of the university or the school or any organization or anyone other than myself. Mr. Chairman, there appears to be a pattern developing. I had 20 copies of my written testimony prepared for the committee. Unfortunately, what I put in my briefcase are my briefs that are due in the United States Supreme Court on April 4th.
Would you like to share those with the group? I'm sure that
Well, it's Ashcroft versus Oregon, and I would prefer not to, so.
Okay. That's not.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
May I ask your permission, however, to submit it first thing in the morning?
That would be fine. We'll make sure it gets around to members.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm speaking in favor of House File Number 1921 on the basis that Minnesota law, as it currently exists, permits any minor, regardless of age. The minor could be the age of 8, 11, 13, 14, although the typical image that defenders of the current state of affairs try to evoke is the age of 16 or 17. But note that the present law does not limit itself to that. The present law allows any minor, regardless of age, to self-consent to treatment for mental illness, alcohol, drug abuse, venereal disease, or pregnancy-related condition. Now, what will probably transpire this evening, if it follows the pattern that occurred last year, the pattern that I observed when I tried to talk to individual legislators in their office, or the pattern that occurred in a public forum that was conducted at the Minnesota Public Health Association, is that for the most part we won't spend a lot of time talking about self-consent to mental treatment for mental illness, alcohol, or drug abuse. For the simple fact that there is almost no responsible practitioner that would attempt to provide treatment for mental illness, drug abuse, or alcohol without involving the family. Imagine, if you will, trying to provide treatment to a minor without telling the parents that that minor is undergoing treatment for alcohol abuse so that those parents could empty the alcohol cabinet at home. Imagine, if you will, trying to provide treatment to a minor for drug abuse without engaging in some sort of family therapy, without knowing a family history of depression or some other sort of psychological history. Imagine, if you will, administering contemporary drugs for psychological or psychiatric illness without having the sort of eyes and ears of the custodial parents to note if there were adverse effects. Remember, just the last month or so, the congressional hearings that were conducted about antidepressants, and note the concern that has been expressed about the fact that modern medications are almost never tested on minors because of the consent issues. The fact is, as the Surgeon General for the United States has noted, when you administer new medication to minors, it's always almost an experiment. So almost no responsible practitioner of the medical arts is going to undertake treatment for mental illness, alcohol, or drug abuse without involving the family, unless the family just isn't there. House File 1921 specifically addresses that situation for the abandoned or institutionalized minor. So that situation is adequately addressed in this legislation. However, what is not the point that is addressed, and what is often the point of contention, is the fact that proponents of the status quo will want to talk about the fact that teens need access to contraception. But let's look at the history there, too. And let me bring to your attention some contemporary stories. On March 31st in 2000, a 16-year-old girl in Portland, Oregon, went to her local high school clinic where she received an injection of Depo-Provera. According to news reports, that girl went into the clinic to get a pregnancy test. The clinic was funded through Title X federal funds, and she subsequently became dizzy and fell. The 16-year-old said she was not fully informed of the drug's possible side effects, and when her stepfather complained to the Portland School Board, he was told that they would not discuss the specifics of any case because of patient confidentiality. Well, what about the case in McHenry County, Illinois, where a 13-year-old was taken repeatedly to a clinic for birth control pills in order that she could continue her sexual relationship with her 37-year-old gym teacher. That case caused those local officials to forego Title X funding because they decided parents have a right to know. They have a need to know. Or maybe we should consider the case in Walton County, Georgia, where a girl went in looking for a pelvic exam and mentioned the fact that she had a heart murmur. Thank goodness in that case, the nurse was at least worried about malpractice liability and said she wasn't going to go forward without a note from her doctor. The doctor subsequently told the parents that if the nurse had gone forward and given her the shot of Depo-Provera, not knowing of the heart murmur, there's a good possibility that the girl could have gone into cardiac arrest and died because of the heart condition. The Supreme Court has acknowledged that all of these sorts of situations are part of the reason that they believe that parental involvement is in the best interest of minors. They have stated specifically that an adequate medical and psychological case history is important to the physician. Parents can provide medical and psychological data, refer the physician to other sources of medical history, such as family physicians, and authorize family physicians to give relevant data. Healthcare providers, in turn, will have the opportunity to discuss the proposed treatment plan, discussing any medical risks with a mature adult who can more accurately assess the risks and benefits of the proposed treatment. Minors' health care will also be improved because they will ensure that parents have the knowledge to respond and recognize any complications that will develop. According to a study by the Minnesota Organization on Adolescent Pregnancy Prevention and Parenting, in 1998, 29% of fathers of the births to teen girls age 14 and 15 were men 20 years of age or older. That statistic is significantly smaller than the percentage found by the most comprehensive study done to date by Dr. Mike Males. In a study of over 46,000 pregnancies by school-age girls in California, he found that 71% were fathered by post-adult high school men that were on average 5 years older than the girls. What about STDs? Well, the fact is that Minnesota is not doing too well there either. We have seen a tremendous increase in sexually transmitted infections. Between 2001 and 2002, the rate of chlamydia increased by 21% and the rate of gonorrhea by 13%. And just last year, between 2002 and 2003, syphilis increased by 31%.
Excuse me, but we have a number of testifiers. If we could wrap up
certainly
briefly, I'd appreciate it.
According to the Department of Health, this segment is represented most commonly by those in ages 15 to 24. The simple fact is this law is a failure. It doesn't protect minors, and it cuts adults out of the loop, adults who care. Doctors will tell you they care, but they can't protect our kids. And that's what the research does. Representative Wilkins' bill will help fix this situation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And if you are able to say this, sure. I'd like to have all the testifiers have a chance. And then if there's questions, we may come back to you again. Thank you very much for your testimony. Sarah Hoffman? Good evening. Welcome to the committee. And if you'd also introduce yourself as you begin.
My name is Sarah Cooper, Mr. Chairman. I support this proposed bill for many different reasons. If this sort of law was in place when I was growing up, it would have made a big change in my life. My name is Sarah, and I'm 18 years old. When I was about 14 or 15, I started to become very sexually active and involved with alcohol and drugs. Many of my friends had gone to Planned Parenthood or the local clinics to get birth control or condoms or STD checks and pregnancy tests just to get this done without the parents knowing. I wanted to go and get on birth control too. My sister had gone to Planned Parenthood to get birth control pills without my parents' knowledge. As a result, she started using the pill unaware of her family medical history. Our family is allergic to a certain kind of birth control drug. My sister ended up collapsing in school and had to go to the emergency room. My parents had no idea where she had gotten birth control pills and asked her friends' parents and even went to Planned Parenthood, which they ended up turning her away and denied having ever treated her. I started going to the clinic to get STD checks, antibiotics to treat chlamydia, pregnancy tests, and condoms. I went during school hours and took others with me. When I went to the clinic, they would ask for a secret address and a phone number and a friend's name to use when they called to report the results. This was all in an effort to keep my parents from learning about my sexual activities. One time I got results saying that I had abnormal cells, and then I got results saying that I had signs of genital warts. I was just 15 and didn't have any money for any treatment anywhere else. They just turned me away and finally told my, they just turned me away and said I had to go and find another place. I ended up telling my parents. I told my mom that I had an infection and I had to go to a doctor. So they were already worried about secrets that I been keeping from them and missing all the school, and that they couldn't find out what was going on. At the doctor's office, the nurse who helped me filled out the forms, she knew the reason why I was really there. For about 15 or 20 minutes, she told me that I had rights and I didn't have to tell my parents anything. In fact, she told me, and she tried to talk me out of telling my parents at all. I was scared and I didn't know if I should sign the confidentiality paper or not, and I ended up not signing the paper, even though she tried to sign me. I wouldn't have known or been able to do anything about the genital warts because the free clinic wouldn't provide me any more treatment. I was cured of the genital warts, for which I'm very thankful. I continued to have sex and abuse drugs even after this episode. My parents still had no knowledge of my secret life after this because they weren't given any more information. I continued to deny having sex and using drugs. My addiction went further, much further. I was having sex with a lot more and a lot older men, usually not protected and running away from home at times and skipping school. I never had to go to my parents because I had other options, and that really just encouraged me to not stop from the destruction that was going on in my life. Now I realize many things. I believe that if I had not had the option to go to the clinic without my parents' knowledge, I would have had to tell my parents. I couldn't have handled not knowing the STD test results and the pregnancy test. That fear would have been overwhelming. I had options to go around my parents, and it was more of an invitation to continue what I was really doing. By telling them about my behavior and going with them to a clinic to get help would have prevented more problems. I fully support this bill. I saw the clinics before as my secret drug dealers. They really supported my habit, no questions asked, and kept a secret from my parents. This made me feel like it was an encouragement and a door to keep going when it really was a spiral downwards. Thank you.
Ms. Hoffer, thank you very much for your courage and for your testimony. Thank you. Everyone with us? Good evening. Welcome.
Good evening. My name is Evelyn Eubanks. I am the mother of six, and I'm here tonight to speak on behalf of my children, three of which have come with me today, Anthony, Brandon, and Whitney, three youngest ones. I have three who are adults now. My concern about what has been allowed to occur is that people have made assumptions about parents. We're assuming the children have the authority to make decisions without us. No one loves my children more than me. No one knows my children more than me. No one should have a right to intervene on medical decisions without me. No one should have that authority. When you usurp the parent's authority, you're making a judgment call. You're saying that somebody other than me has better judgment when it comes to my children. That has been a dangerous perception, and this cost us a lot. In North Minneapolis, where we live, we have one of the highest teenage pregnancy rates. You cannot tell kids that you can do something without a value call. There's no such thing as teaching children that something is related to how you feel and what you value and what you believe. When I tell my children that they should abstain because they're too young to know what the consequences are, no one should have the right to go behind me and say, not only can you do it, we will help you and show you how. This experiment has failed. Look at the statistics and look at the numbers. It has failed and it has continued to fail. And when you support children to make decisions outside their parents in this area, what are you telling them about other areas? Who has a right to take away my God-given authority to oversee every aspect of my children's education, medical care, and guidance? No one should have ever been given that right. It was a mistake. For those parents who don't want to be involved, who can't be involved, we have laws and rules and regulations to govern those issues. Those people who don't do right should not be used to characterize the rest of us and take away all rights from all parents, especially in this particular incident. In conclusion, I would say that it is difficult to turn back the hands of time and admit the mistakes that have been made. But if you look at the outcome of what these assumptions led to, it is clear that this didn't work. Telling children that you can have sex and you can go get shots and you can go to a clinic without parents was not only contrary, it was backwards, it was counterproductive, it's divisive, and it is helping to destroy the very fiber in which this society is built on, and that's the family. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Wilkins, is that the witnesses that you have on your behalf?
That's my final witness on behalf of the bill.
Okay. And, well, we have some testifiers, I think, that I'm assuming other testifiers that wish to speak in opposition or at least have concerns about it. First is Dr. Amy Gilbert. Good evening. Welcome to the committee, and you can each introduce yourselves as you begin testimony.
Thank you. Representative Chairman, Mr. Bradley, members of the committee. My name is Amy Gilbert. I'm a family medical physician practicing at Family Tree Clinic in St. Paul. I speak today on behalf of over 10,000 physician, resident, and student members of the Minnesota Medical Association. As you know, since 1971, Minnesota's minor consent law has allowed minors to seek specific medical services without parental consent, including emergency medical care, initial mental health care, drug or alcohol abuse evaluation and treatment, STD, sexually transmitted infection testing and treatment, contraceptive care, and pregnancy-related care, excluding abortions. This law remains critical today because it provides a way for teens in risky situations to access a knowledgeable adult who can assess and treat their condition and assist them in approaching their parents. I know that I and other clinicians that I know and work with try to assist adolescents in establishing and building relationships with their parents. Not all minors have a healthy relationship with their parents. Sometimes we find that when a teen comes to clinic and they'll say, you know, I need confidentiality, I'm very worried about this. When we sit and talk with them, we'll say, you know, what would happen if you did? And don't you think that would be a good idea? But often they'll say, well, you know, maybe I could. And the next time they come back to clinic and they've got their insurance card and they've talked to their parents. And some teens with encouragement can do that. Others can't, and they don't have the fortune of that relationship with their parents. The minor consent law provides a way for teens to receive critical health care services confidentially that they might otherwise forgo. It was in September of 2002, the Journal of the AMA found that 80% of unmarried adolescent females would not seek birth control if their parents had to be told, but less than 1% would stop having sex. Denying them access to confidential services does not enhance the relationship with their parents. We need to find other ways to do that. We need to help teach parents to talk to their kids, encourage the kids to talk to their parents. Removing access to safe, confidential health services won't do that. The current minor's consent law requires parental involvement if maintaining confidentiality would jeopardize the minor's health or if health concerns beyond these limited confidential issues are discovered during a medical visit. For example, if I discovered a heart murmur on an exam, that doesn't come under this law and that would need to be dealt with the parents. It's essential that we make sure teens have access to confidential health services when they need them. They do engage in risky behaviors sometimes. According to data from the Minnesota Department of Health, 7.5% of Minnesota ninth graders reported trying to commit suicide during the past year. 40% of 12th graders report having had sexual intercourse three or more times. 34% of 12th graders report engaging in binge drinking. 16% of ninth graders report using marijuana in the last month. Minnesota cannot afford to have teens not seeking critical health care services because the teen would rather go without treatment than involve their parents. Representative Wilkins said that this bill aims to put the parents back into the formula. I want to say that the minor's consent law never took them out. There's nothing that prohibits or restricts teens from talking to their parents or parents talking to their teens, and that's what they need to be doing. I urge you to vote against House File 1921. Repealing this law leaves the ultimate decision on whether or not to involve the parent to the minor. But if the decision is not to involve the parent, the minor won't receive health care, and the health care provider won't have the chance to try to involve the parent. It's important that teens receive treatment for STDs, mental health, and critical health services that are covered by this law. I'd like to share the second part of my time with Rebecca Wright of CAMS Clinic.
Good evening.
Chair and members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Wright, and I am the clinic manager at Teenage Medical Service, which is the adolescent outpatient clinic at children's hospitals and clinics. I'm hoping that you will consider not sending forward this bill that would remove a young person's ability to confidentially access these health care services in certain situations. The reality is that both I and the staff I work with believe in the importance that the parents play in the lives of young people. We take very seriously our role as adults who young people confide in when they believe they have no other options. Our health educators run workshops for mothers and daughters that help them practice talking to each other and about sensitive topics and help each other understand what the other is experiencing during this very important developmental period. Our providers routinely encourage young people to talk with their parents. We also know that for many youth, the only reason they are willing to come for care is because they know they can consent for the care themselves and that it will be confidential. Unfortunately, we know they sometimes fear telling their parents far more than they fear the consequences of a sexually transmitted disease or a pregnancy. Many youth of this situation come to us because they have already had sex. One story, Julia, not her real name, had sex once, never wants to have sex again, recognizes that it was a terrible decision for her, has a very wonderful, involved mother who's communicated very high expectations. Julia waited a year worrying about having contracted an STD before she talked to anyone. After a year, she finally approached an adult who could help her get the health care she needed. Julia recognizes she made a terrible mistake, but she cannot bear the disappointment she knows she would see in her mother's eyes if she talked with her about this. You and I can reflect on this situation and say, yes, your mom might be angry. She probably will be disappointed. And we can say, you know, parents want to protect their kids from all of the harm in the world. And it's hard for parents to see their kids struggling, especially when they want to protect them. So one of the roles that we at the clinic play is helping young people like Julia talk to their parents, get up the courage to talk, even when it might disappoint them. Young people will sacrifice their own health to avoid disappointing their parents. They tell us that if they had to tell their parents, they would just hope that whatever they're concerned about, an infection, the possibility of a pregnancy, they'll just hope that it goes away. As adults, we can see the consequences of an infection or a too early pregnancy, and we know that delays in care for an infection can lead to infertility and that lack of access to birth control can lead to pregnancy. Again, while involvement of the family is supported and encouraged, it would be a terrible disservice for a teen not to receive early prenatal care because she was too scared to tell her parents. It would be a terrible disservice for a young man to not have an infection treated because of struggling with how to explain the symptoms to his family. I hope that you will help us to provide these essential services to the teens in our community by opposing this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Patricia, is it Seibert? Good evening.
Good evening, Chairman Bradley and members of the committee. My name is Patricia Siebert. I'm an attorney with the Minnesota Disability Law Center, and I work primarily with individuals who have mental illness disabilities. And I'm here to focus on one particular aspect of Section 3. I am concerned about the barriers that it may raise to timely chemical dependency and mental health treatment for minors, particularly those who are in dysfunctional family situations. Under current law, a minor may consent to medical, mental, and other health services to treat alcohol and other drug abuse. As you know, House File 1921 would remove that provision unless the minor seeking chemical dependency treatment is the victim of incest. Minors in other circumstances, including minors who are victims of other forms of maltreatment, would need parental consent, and that's kind of where my concern lies. In an ideal world, parents ought to be there to consent to chemical dependency and mental health treatment for their kids. But obtaining consent can be a very complex matter for children whose parents have chemical dependency issues themselves. And I don't think all of these children are on the radar scope of the child welfare and other authorities who can intervene and in that regard. I just want to briefly share some data from the National Association of Children of Alcoholics as one example of what some of these kids are dealing with. There are 11 million children of alcoholics under the age of 18. They are four times more likely to develop alcoholism than the general population. They're more likely to be targets of physical abuse and to witness family violence. National child protection data shows that in 81% of cases, substance abuse is one of the two top problems
exhibited by these families. Mental illness and chemical dependency go hand in hand. Comorbidity is very high, especially for depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety disorders, and bipolar disorders. In fact, children of alcoholics end up having triple the inpatient chemical dependency rates of other kids. These children are probably the least likely to have parental involvement in seeking chemical dependency and related mental health treatment, and the statute does specifically talk about mental health treatment related to chemical dependency. And children who do seek this treatment on their own should be supported and not turned away. So I'd like to urge the committee to preserve the existing statutory language enabling minors to consent to treatment for chemical dependency and related mental health issues. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to raise this particular issue.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Patricia Harrison? Good evening. Welcome.
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Patricia Harrison, and I represent the Minneapolis Department of Health and Family Support, which is the public health agency in Minneapolis. I am here to speak in opposition to this bill and will focus my comments on reproductive health services. I do think it's important when we deliberate the pros and cons of this bill to have accurate information, so I'd like to start by refuting a couple statements that were made. About whether things are getting worse among teens, there were statements made that pregnancy is on the rise. That is false. Pregnancies among teens aged 15 to 17 in the state of Minnesota have declined by almost half since 1980. That is a huge decline. I have my testimony in a larger brief with all the specific citations, so I won't go into that. But I think that's important to know. There was also a statement about the rise in sexually transmitted diseases. You must know that when we talk about rates of sexually transmitted diseases, we're only talking about the people who get tested. Those are the ones we count. So if we can get more people to get tested, the rates go up. The actual rate of infected people, we do not know. But this increase around 2001 is due most likely to the fact that new technology made a change for men available that a urine test can now detect chlamydia and gonorrhea. Before that, it was a very painful, invasive procedure, and young men avoided getting testing. So this may merely reflect what we in public health think is a good thing, an increase in young people who are sexually active getting tested. We have no data that the actual rise has occurred at all. I also want to mention that since we know that pregnancies have declined by such a great number, we cannot say that this law in any way has contributed to an increase. There are other studies that talk about what teens would do, and these are when they are surveyed anonymously or confidentially. 90 to 99% of kids that are sexually active said they will continue to be sexually active if parental notification is mandated, but they will probably not use contraception, or they will rely on condoms and hope that their partner withdraws before ejaculation. There have been several studies. One was confined to Minnesota and Wisconsin teens, very similar answers. Another study surveyed kids who were using reproductive health services in 33 states, very similar answers. Kids will say that they will continue to have sex, but they will just do it in very, very unsafe ways. To my knowledge, there's actually been only one jurisdiction that has changed their law from a minor's consent to a mandated parental notification. This occurred in McHenry County, Illinois in 1998, and they have tracked pregnancies since that time. In that one county, pregnancy rates increased in subsequent years, while in every surrounding county, pregnancy rates among minors decreased. All of this, I don't want to diminish the social issues and the social costs. The humanitarian concerns, I do believe, are uppermost. But policymakers must also concern themselves with economic issues. In Texas, where the law has been changed to require parental consent for minors to receive contraceptives, there has been a cost analysis conducted that estimates that the annual cost that will occur because of increased pregnancies, abortions, and other medical problems among teenage girls will cost the state of Texas $44 million each year. And this model is conservative because it only looked at costs related to girls, and it only looked at publicly funded dollars. So it does not count the cost of private insurers for increased teen pregnancies. If we apply that model to all the data we know about Minnesota, the current rate of pregnancies, the likelihood of increase, what we know it costs for a birth and prenatal care, the estimate would be $11 million annually, resulting from an increase in pregnancies and sexually transmitted diseases. These models, I want to emphasize again, are extremely conservative. Let me just mention a few things that are not covered in these models. All the medical costs associated with males, primarily sexually transmitted disease costs, any costs that might be associated with a possible increase in HIV or AIDS because people fear getting tested, the neonatal intensive care costs for preterm infants, which are more likely to occur to minors, long-term health care costs related to infertility, and unfortunately, this is something that will affect girls who get pelvic inflammatory disease as a result of chlamydia or something else, and it goes unrecognized and untreated. As you can tell, that most of these consequences really do affect young females disproportionately. Then there's the long-term societal cost that everyone will bear. We know that this includes the family's long-term dependence on government assistance and the high rates of juvenile delinquency among teens. Hennepin County did a study a few years back that showed that 55% of families that were on government assistance long-term started with a teen birth. 70% of families that have children deemed delinquent under the age of 10 started with a teen birth. And 75% of families that they classify among their highest cost families in terms of extreme social cost needs started with a teen birth. We cannot estimate the total cost that may occur if pregnancy rates should suddenly start on the upswing because of change in this birth. I want to emphasize that Minnesota has the fourth lowest pregnancy rate in the country among 15 to 17-year-olds. So it's hard to see how this law has hurt anything. By contrast, Texas has the sixth worst, and that isn't where we want to go. So I urge you to think carefully again about the detail, the studies, what teens say, what parents themselves say, because even parents that are queried that generally think, when they first hear about this law, think it sounds like a good idea, 96% of those parents believe that there will be adverse consequences in terms of increased pregnancies and untreated sexually transmitted diseases. So it's a complicated issue, but I do think that those kinds of considerations need to also be part of the deliberations. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. I believe that concludes the people who requested. Is there anyone else that wishes to testify regarding this bill? See no one. Representative Wilson, we turn to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, I'd like to reply to a few of the things that have been stated. Ms. Harrison cites pregnancies declined since 1980, while the original law passed in 1971. I think that's our baseline, not 1980. With regard to the McHenry County, I think that is a great case study because they basically went to a situation where they're requiring parental consent for family planning. Ms. Harrison is correct that pregnancies went up in McHenry County. Let's talk about the rest of the story, though. 0.69%. Not 69%. 0.69%. That's kind of the nub of the issue here, that we're disenfranchising parents from being parents for a 0.69% improvement. That's a variability that can happen year to year or in any given time period. It's kind of ridiculous to hang your hat on that. It was stated that providers routinely counsel their children to talk to their parents. I'm sure some good counselors do, or some good providers do that. But we've had plenty of testimony, both this year and last. We had several young women that we had testify last year. Because of time, we weren't able to schedule them all this year. The recurring theme that we heard was that the clinics were discouraging them from talking to their parents. Discouraging, not encouraging. And that was happening at, by the way, at Planned Parenthood clinics. We're also told about dysfunctional family situations. I think it's a little bit ridiculous to legislate based on the least common denominator. You take the worst case scenario of a parent who might not be a good parent. I don't think we want to legislate something that takes good parents, the vast majority of parents who are good parents, and take them out of the children's lives and decision-making process on these important issues. And I could go on and on, but I think maybe it would be good to just take questions from members.
Any questions, members? Question, Goodman.
Representative, Mr. Chair, I think, and Representative Wilson, I'm very concerned about the teens that that will not go to get mental health care. I worked in children's mental health for several years, and I knew children that parents did not believe in mental health care. They had no option to go, and I also know a girl that was 17 years old that committed suicide as a result of not getting the mental health care that she wanted to go get, but her parents would not allow her to go get. This is only going to make that situation worse. And as you heard me say on the floor today, Minnesota is very high in the number of suicides of children 10 years of age and over, all the way up to age 24. We're second. That's the second leading cause of death. We're in the nation. It's the third leading cause of death. I really am concerned about the mental health effects of this. I know many children that that got mental health care, but it was very late. They were ashamed. It's difficult enough to get kids to get help when they need it, and that's why we have so many teens committing suicide. I really think that there's such a big stigma to it, as well as the parents of the children not wanting that stigma attached to them. So I have very serious concerns about that, and I think your bill is going to do a lot of damage in that area. And I think if one child dies because they didn't feel comfortable going to get help, that's one too many. And I think it'll be a lot more than that. If their parents or guardians have to see their medical records, I think there'll be more children dying as well who are committing suicide, and instead of getting help for sexually transmitted diseases or for pregnancies. I think there's ways to do this, but your bill is too. It's too broad. It's too broad. It covers too many things, and it eliminates too many minors from getting help. And I wish you'd reconsider that and work with some people on the committee to make some changes.
Mr. Wilkin, if I understood the question, apparently we do very poorly as far as the rate of suicide amongst teenagers. What's the current law in terms of consent in that regard?
Mr. Chairman, they would have to... The current law is that the minors can consent to that.
So the current law is not succeeded too well, Representative Wilkin?
Yeah, that would seem to me to be the case. This law isn't in effect, or my bill isn't in effect now, so the current law appears to be failing the teams that are going through those situations that Representative Goodwin mentioned. But Representative Goodwin, let me make you an offer. I've repeated this offer to the opponents each year I've brought this bill up. I'm willing to make reasonable compromises. I'm willing to work with you to figure out how to carve out so we can address the situations where the parents are maybe unreasonably withholding consent for, say, mental health care. If there be some kind of bypass situation, I'm willing to work on language to carve that out. This bill is full of compromises from what it was originally introduced as last year, and I think it's a better bill because of that. If we can find a way to identify when a when a parent is being negligent in their duty, I'm willing to do that, but I'm not willing to leave the situation where it currently is and disenfranchise all parents from these important decisions with regard to the upbringing of their children.
Representative Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, in regard to your comment, Minnesota isn't the only state that has this, situation the way we have it now. Over half the states do, and yet Minnesota is higher than over half the states in suicide. So I don't, there's no cause and effect relationship there. You're only going to make it harder, I'm saying, for those kids to get the help that they need. So maybe our rates will go up even more. There's that chance. You can't make a cause and effect relationship here between the fact that that law is out there now and we're high in, the suicide rate. You can't make that cause and effect because then the other states would too. But Minnesota is higher. So then we try to find ways to, prevent that. We don't make put ways in that'll make it even more, there'll be even more suicides. And Representative Wilkin, I think I'd be willing to work with you on this. But I think what you're going to want is way beyond what is reasonable. This is another MCCL bill, quite frankly, and I don't think they're going to allow you to make the kind of changes that need to be made to help. Let me tell you one little story. I used to give kids tours of the Capitol, and especially alternative high school kids when I worked here. And I used to make them representatives and say, you can do anything you want, what do you want to do? They wanted to work on the bill we passed several years ago to require a parent to come along to court with them, because previously there was no law regarding that, and Representative Skoglund was putting it in law that a parent had to be with you if you had to go to court. I let them just discuss what would happen. And they said, they came up with a very reasonable solution to the problem. But they did say, different ones said different things. One said, my parent would abuse me so badly I'd never make it to court if I had to tell them that I had to go to court. Another one said that the parents made minimum wage and couldn't ever take a day off for work. They came up with an amendment on their own to say that the child had to go get somebody that was an adult, a responsible adult over the age of 18 that a judge would approve of. And that's what passed into law. But the abuse that those kids talked about was the kind of reason that a lot of kids do not. I know the people that testify here are very good parents, and I believe that. But there are a lot of people out there that are drug abusers. There are people out there that are abusive, physically abusive to their kids. And they can't tell them these things, and we're not making any allowance for any of that in here.
Mr.
Chairman, if I could address one misstatement from Representative Goodwin, and I appreciate your position. I understand that not everybody's going to agree on this issue. This isn't an MCCL bill. They don't endorse it. They don't take any position on it. This is a Tim Wilkin bill. This is Dad Wilkin, concern for my children and the children of other Minnesotans. If any organization is behind this bill, it is the Minnesota Family Council. They strongly endorse it, but no other organization has been the advocate of this. I've been the main advocate.
And Representative Wilkin and Representative Goodwin, I think you're correct in saying there's no proof for cause-effect, and frankly, I heard an awful lot of cause-effect in our testimony that I would question. But likewise, then, I don't know that you could draw any conclusion about cause-effect the other way. As a matter of fact, labor case that you mentioned, I could bring to your attention cases that have been in my life where I've had kids in my church youth group who, had it not been for the parental intercession, they would not have sought help. They would have committed suicide. They would have gone over the edge, but for the involvement of their parents, who basically pushed them into seeking mental health help. In one case, in another case, chemical dependency. So, I mean, we can find an example, but I don't know that you could argue that if we change our law, that you've hypothesized that it increases. It may very well decrease. And I could give you just as many cases where the parental involvement made a difference in terms of those youth getting what they needed that they never would have sought on their own.
Well, Mr. Chair.
That's a good one.
And I believe you. I believe there are a lot of cases like that. But I believe that you haven't been exposed to the kind of families I've been exposed to in the work that I've done in the past, or the kind of issues that I've been exposed to, or the neighborhoods that I've lived in and been exposed to. All parents are not like that. And I think if the parents are like that, those children are going to go to those parents. There's no two ways. Or the parents are going to be observant enough about their kids that they're going to see something's going on, and they're going to push to unite with them on those issues. Those aren't the kind of parents we're talking about here, or the kind of families. I've seen families where 17 people were living on the floor with absolutely no furniture, no food in the refrigerator. The parents were all doing drugs. We had testimony here from the boy that's in the meth program. And he said that every single person in his family was a meth user. I wonder if he would have been younger, if he could have gone into meth treatment without his parents okay. How do you get the parents okay to go into meth treatment when they're all meth users in the family? They don't want you to be different. I'm just saying you maybe don't have the same exposure to the kind of situations, life situations, and family situations that I have. All parents are not able to do what I'm sure you would do.
Well, that's a good one. I don't deny that at all, but I think Ms. Rosebank's brought to our attention seems to me to be a little strange that we would penalize the, I don't know what percent, but the 90, 80, pick a number, a significant number of parents who are very functional parents, who care more about their kids than any doctor, anybody ever could. And we shouldn't set the standard based on, unfortunately, bad situations. And Representative Wilkins actually offered, if you have something that you want to try to do that could deal with those, I still think, unusual situations when you look at the mass of our populations. The point is, if we don't do this, we're denying Ms. Newbanks and me and Representative Wilkins and other parents. And by the way, I think in the last year, if I count, we had at least 8 or 9 young people testify, and these were coming from families where they consider their parents to be good parents, and they have denied the contact with their parents. Representative Huntley.
Well, Mr. Chair, I want to talk just about one individual whose life was saved by the current law. Young woman in Duluth, from a really nice middle class family, no alcohol, no drugs, by either, no abuse from the parents, wonderful family, a wonderful young woman. She made a bad mistake. She had unprotected sex when she was 16, got worried about it, thought that maybe she, after a while, she should be checked out for STDs, and she went to a clinic in Duluth and found that she had a very aggressive form of AIDS. And she told me 2 years ago that she never would have gone to that clinic if she needed parental permission. She never would, and if she had waited another month, she would have died. She's alive today. She's 23 years old. She's working, she has a good job, she's obviously going to have to live with AIDS for the rest of her life, but the current law saved her life, and this law would kill her.
Now, Representative Huntley, in the several examples that I just mentioned, those kids would have died because their parents wouldn't have been there for them. So I know we can all find, and that's a tragic case, and my heart goes out to them. I don't know. We can all find individual cases, but I'm also very familiar with cases where, had it not been for the parental involvement, those kids would have been gone. Any further discussion, members? Let's continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Wilkin. I just want to applaud you for bringing this forward. And I want to speak in favor of this bill because I think, first of all, with the issue of sexually transmitted diseases in teens, currently in the current law, under the mandatory, we're providers who test for sexually transmitted diseases are obligated to share that information with the state, so that teens who are tested and they are positive are automatically by law sharing that information with the state already. But it's ironic to me that we're not sharing that information with mom and dad. Number two, I think that I would agree with Professor Collette that there are many things that parents, we can argue about whether or not parents should take these roles, but there are certain things that whether parents should or shouldn't do things that doctors don't. There's some things that parents can do better, and I think Professor Collette indicated correctly that they can share medical history, and I think that that's a very important point, particularly with the health of our kids. And these are kids who are in vulnerable situations who have we're very impressionable and under a lot of stresses and pressures that we hear about in this committee on a daily basis. And number two, they can also share, and they can do this that doctors can't do, they can share their family's culture and their values, and they can bring to those decisions those things that are specific to that family. And that's another thing that parents can do that doctors can't do. And in terms of managing these crisis points for teens, I think that the earlier the better, because we've seen on this committee again and again and again the trajectory, the beginning with alcohol and then to drugs and then to other things, where the earlier that the parents can intervene, the better. And I want to applaud you for this bill, and I also want to say that this is a if you're against this bill, you're saying that the problem is that parents are too involved. And I think that that's incorrect.
Further discussion? It's one of those kind of nights. All right, what's the top like? You back? Well, I think we're getting close to the end of our discussion, though, but I think, remember, we have to respect that people do have to vote in other committees, so we'll hang loose at just a few minutes here and get them back so we can have votes.
I'm fine going anytime, Mr. Chairman.
Well, I think we do know sort of what the end result would be, and we probably have enough of a mixture now, but I think in fairness to members, so they're going to be back shortly. I don't think so. I know. It's a big Representative Ruth around? Okay, why don't we'll hold this bill for its vote. Let's see, what would be proper? The chair will just lay this on the table until we can come back to it. We'll proceed with Representative Ruth. Representative Ruth, I'll move that your bill, House File 1272, be recommended to pass, and I believe it has to be referred to Commerce.
Correct.
Is that correct?
Mr.
Okay.
Chair.
I'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I have to follow this properly because we did have a subcommittee on this. And I'll withdraw that motion that I just made. I need to move the acceptance of the subcommittee report because this was reviewed in the subcommittee. And the subcommittee did review this and recommended that the bill pass and be referred back to us. So that's the essence of the motion from the subcommittee. You all understand that motion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. I did really well. Well, it's a little confusing, members, I realize, but when we have a subcommittee, that committee has a full hearing on this. This bill has had that full hearing, and I think it's also a fairly short bill as well. So that puts it before us now. Now I can make the motion that House File 1272 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Commerce. Representative, to your bill, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Yes, this one will hopefully will be a little less controversial and very short. But basically, this includes marriage and family therapists in the list of professional services in Section 148B. And with that, I have testifier Bob Butler, who is Executive Director of Minnesota Board of Marriage and Family Therapy.
Mr. Butler, and if you can be brief, because this has been heard before the committee, I appreciate it. Welcome to committee.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm simply here to inform you that the Board of Marriage and Family Therapy, while this is not specifically their bill, they have unanimously endorsed the inclusion of marriage and family therapists in 319B.
Any questions, members? Hearing none, I'll renew my motion that House File 1272 be recommended to pass and refer to the Committee on Commerce. All those in favor say aye. 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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Let the record show. The other bill. I believe your committee said this was okay.
They, Mr. Chair, they had a very good co-author.
Oh, did they? Okay, well, the bill we just handled was the marriage therapy license bill. So that's been done. All right, Chair will remove from the table House File 1921. Yes. Roll call has been requesting that bill. We will have a roll call. Representative Wilkin, you... Representative Goodman.
I just want to make one final point, Mr. Chair. I understand that the parents and your youth group had an intervention that saved some kids, and they did their intervention under this law with the privacy provisions under this law. So just want to make that point, and let's go ahead and get the vote.
The discussion? I think we're ready to vote. We have a roll call requested. No, I'm sorry. We asked for public testimony and we were into discussion, so we're concluding and going to a vote. I apologize, but that's our process now. I remove a motion. Representative Wilkin removes his motion that House File 1921 be recommended to pass and referred to the General Register. Correct the motion? You all understand the motion? Take the vote.
Bradley.
Yes.
Benstead.
Yes.
Abler.
Yes.
Dean.
Yes.
Deacon.
Deacon.
Ammer.
Yes.
Goodwin.
No.
Huntley.
No.
Otremba.
Yes.
Pepin.
Yes.
Powell.
Yes.
Samuelson.
Yes.
Powell. Thiessen.
No.
Walker.
No. No.
Wilson?
Yes.
There being 10 ayes and 4 nays, the motion is adopted. Thank you, Representative Booker. Representative Faber.
Is everybody happy with this?
Again, well, Representative Huntley, would you... I'll say that you're making the motion. We have to make the motion to accept the committee report.
Oh, okay.
And that's all. So would you make that motion, please?
Mr. Chair, I move that we accept the committee report, subcommittee report.
And to acknowledge the members, you don't have it in front, but in fact, there were 2 amendments adopted in that committee. I believe the summary that we have, the House Research Summary, is to the original bill, but I think staff has told me, though, that it doesn't change the summary. And I believe we put the amendments in people's folders, just so you had a chance to see, even those were already adopted. And so, first of all, I have a motion before us, which is to accept the committee report. Once we do that, then we'll have a motion on the bill. For all those in favor of accepting the committee report, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The committee report is adopted. Now we have the motion, and I believe... Representative Abel, if you'd like to make the motion, I think we'll make it to the unofficial engrossment. That's titled H1294UE-1.
Mr. Chair, it was thought, the reason it's built in here tonight and not later is that I thought I had to go to DevOps because it's talked about rulemaking. In fact, it's only a recodification of rulemaking, and DevOps, upon further review, does not want to see it. So if you may, I suggest that we act on an amendment and then lay the bill back over in the finance.
This indeed removes that House file, I'll get my numbers right here, 1294, as shown in the document titled H1294UE-1, which is amended in subcommittee, be held open for possible inclusion in the health omnibus finance bill.
Mr. Chair. No, it would travel alone. Just held over temporarily pending some finance work that has to be done on this. So it would go on its own, I believe, because it will have no net fiscal. No.
Well, we can do it this way, and then we can always pull it back and hear it, and then
it's going to be here.
It's going to be in the preview of our committee all that
correct,
time.
Yeah.
That's the name of you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And the reason that's getting kind of complicated is because the amendment AO50159 that's in your packet has to do with allowing the social workers to lower their fees. If you remember the history of this board, it's been kind of a long story. Maybe 4 years ago, you were lobbied by the NASW, the union, to stop those terrible fees. And because they were going up and they had to cover their costs and they were exorbitant and it was a problem. The board has done a lot of work in that time. And not to be such a feasible out of number, but anyway, they're going to be lowered to a more normal number, and the amendment addressed that. And that in so doing, there was a technical change that needed to be done in allowing the board to extend its surplus. And in so doing that, that's amendment AO50387, which I'll move in a minute. However, Mr. Chair, you're aware there's a special revenue fund where all these monies for all the boards are kept in just kind of a pool. And actually, they know whose money it is, much like my teenage boys know whose pie is which in the fridge, and you better not take it. And they know about the dentists know how much they have in their fund. They all count for it. However, finance has no idea how they do that, and they're interested in becoming part of that process. And so as this bill winds its way through the process, you may see an amendment later on in conference or otherwise that clarifies this bookkeeping. And so for the time being, Mr. Chair, amendment, I'd like to move AO50387, which will clarify that that they can't just spend the money, it has to still be appropriated to them as it will be in your omnibus.
So, Russ and Dave, are you moving amendment AO50387?
That's
amendment.
I put the bill in order, which it can make by the for a week or so.
Okay. So I understand that amendment. I think Representative Wilbur already explained it. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion fails. Amendment is adopted.
And that's what we're going to have for tonight. If you want to just ask any questions, we'll take those if you'd like, Mr. Chair.
There will be a question, I think, in terms of jurisdiction. I mean, we have responsibilities for the special revenue funds as well as general funds and federal funds and so forth. So even if it ends up being neutral for transactions, we'll have to kind of work that out later on. The other thing I want to be sure is, I think we had a handout. This was billed as pretty much all technical, but I think that there might have been some substantive changes to policy.
Well, then, Mr. Chair, we'll testify to those. I didn't know you wanted to hear that.
Yeah, just at least briefly.
There's a one-minute version that they've impacted.
Yeah, if you could just give us the 1 or 2 minute version, I'd appreciate it. Welcome to the committee. If you'd introduce yourselves to begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Frank Merriman. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Social Work. And as Chairman Bradley indicated, the bill is not strictly technical. The bill is quite so big because a lot of it is technical. A major purpose of the bill is to integrate into the board's statutes all of the provisions that are now in the board's rules. So if the legislature passes this legislation, the Board of Social Work would no longer have rules. All of the requirements would be by statute. I'd also like to point out that the bill is non-controversial, even though there are some substantive changes in it, because we work very closely with the associations to develop the proposals. The subcommittee did go over the bill with some thoroughness, and we have passed out a summary, the handout that Chairman Bradley referred to, which summarizes the substantive changes on the first two pages that are in the bill. And then the subcommittee had also requested some more specific information on the changes, and so we've attached to that summary the last three pages is a more detailed description of exactly which provisions are the same and which ones change. But the two-page summary that is at the beginning of the document describes the more important substantive changes. And I will not take the committee's time to go through all of those changes unless requested to do so, but they're all captured in the handout.
Okay, any question, members? Seeing none, Representative Avery renews his motion at House File 1294 as in the document we talked about and as it amended by the amendment we adopted. He held up for possible inclusion and for potential change if the status changes. And Representative Avery, if I understand, there were some finance concerns about maybe permanently reducing the rate as opposed to giving a holiday, and that bounce, is that part of the discussion going on? Are you aware of that?
Maybe Michelle knows something about that part. What the amendment that you adopted requires that we have to appropriate the money. And so this is only a 2-year cycle, so they'll be back, and there'll be another bill every 2 years coming in our budget. So,
sure. Are you familiar with anything more than this?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, yes, I'm familiar with this, and what the language says is it provides an avenue for this expenditure of funds only through a direct appropriation. If there are more comments, I think we have a colleague in the audience who has been also part of the conversation from Department of Finance.
Well, thank you for just a moment, because I think there was a Department of Finance concern. I don't know if Representative Aber had a chance to hear that, so if we could just have a brief comment on that, I appreciate it.
Good evening. Doug Green from the Department of Finance. We are in discussions with the health boards and with Representative Abler on this. There is a financial implications of doing this. It reduces the fees such that the agency does not recover. They do not bring in the revenue to meet their expenditures as all agencies are required to do under statute. This is more of a budgetary decision in Department of Finance's position than it is a fee-setting decision. However, if the chair does not mind, we have a meeting set up tomorrow.
Okay, so this is something that's work in progress then?
Correct. At that point, that maybe the finance people can verify. Certainly, there's a step government fund, which is a pot of money. And as I mentioned, who knows whose it is? They do. But I think when this all settles, it'll be more segmented fund, and so each, and so they can track each specific board's surpluses and deficits, so they can more accurately, so finance can more accurately account for that. I think that's what.
I certainly don't consider that we're ready here. There were some statutory implications in terms of running with a year-by-year deficit anyway. It doesn't sound like that might be the concern, but it sounds like you have work in progress, and that's all I wanted to do is just confirm that this is something that there is an awareness that will be worked on.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, I renewed my motion. I don't think I could do it again because it's so you all understand the motion. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you, Representative Abler. Representative Abler, Representative Emmer is not here, so if you want to pick up your other bill and go ahead with that one. Well, you almost were.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 855, the recommended path, actually be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus, I think is where it's.
Yeah, I think that's correct. President Abel moves that House File 855 be held over for possible inclusion in the omnibus health bill. President Abel, do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill repeals the sunset of the July 105 that would expire then, exempting hemophilia products from prior authorization. This has been a kind of a perennial issue for the last, I think this is my third year or so hanging on with this thing, and my witness can clarify. There was a sunset that 2003 that went till now, there's no fiscal note. The department doesn't intend to pre-authorize these products anyway, and so it's somewhat of a moot point. But it's, I think it's a good idea, and I have to listen to my witness. I hope you'll agree with me, too.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Jim Pace. I'm the Executive Director of the Hemophilia Foundation in Minnesota Dakotas. We provide support and advocacy for people living with hemophilia in Minnesota and Dakotas. We're in support of House File 855, and I'd like to thank Representative Abler for introducing this bill and for recognizing the importance of renewing this exemption for life-saving, blood-clotting factor medication. As many of you may know, hemophilia is a chronic illness which often involves serious complications and challenges in everyday life for those affected. Children, adults with hemophilia sometimes experience excruciatingly painful internal bleeding of their joints and other parts of the body. They rely on rapid access to these factor medications to stop internal bleeding and to prevent future bleeds. Any delays in access to these crucial medications could create life-threatening situations or health risks for those affected. We hope this committee will support House File 855 to extend the current exemption from prior authorization, which is set to expire in July of this year. I'd like to thank you for your attention to this very important matter, and I'm available for questions if anybody has them.
Mr. Pace, I'm very, very sympathetic to the situation that people with hemophilia have. I mean, it's a heck of a life to have to live, I realize. But I want to at least ask you, and as openly and honestly as I can, because I do hear of cases, unfortunately. I mean, these are very expensive, and oftentimes public assistance dollars are involved. And we hear at least some cases of pharmaceutical companies who use interesting approaches to encourage people to take their particular brand name and to require or demand that particular brand name. We have to figure out ways that are cost-effective ways. I mean, that is of the medical treatments, the escalation or the inflation rate of our public assistance dollars is beyond our ability to keep up with. And when you're doing it, oftentimes the place where you look is you look at the places that are one of the bigger expenses, and this is one of them. I guess, first of all, I'd like you to, if you have any thoughts or comments. I mean, I realize that we're not applying the prior authorization, so maybe in this respect, the tool that you would hope doesn't work. But how do we get our arms around this, about the expense, and are the things that I've heard, do you hear any of those kinds of things? Are there cases where pharmaceutical companies maybe, I mean, maybe you've heard some of them, maybe it's urban legend, but it doesn't sound right. So help me first of all understand, how do we control to make sure that the most cost-effective drug is the one being used?
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate your concerns, and certainly cost is an issue. The way we see this particular bill that Representative Abler has been kind enough to introduce is that it's unrelated to some of the cost issues that you raise. And so, for example, I'm sure you're well aware of other legislation that's pending in the works that deals directly with containing costs. We see this as a completely separate issue in terms of access to this life-saving medication for our population. And to respond to your question about any ideas that we may have at the foundation in terms of containing costs for the state, we absolutely want to work with the state. In fact, in contrast to some of the 340B proposals that have been floating around out there, we believe that the most realistic way to address the cost issue is to look at the reimbursement rate. And so we are currently, as a foundation, in the process of putting together a plan or a formula that would look at changing the reimbursement rate as such so that the state would ultimately be paying less. And we believe that would be a direct way to address the cost issue. And again, I just don't see how the prior authorization of this, or the exemption of prior authorization in this particular bill, really relates to the cost issue.
Well, Mr. Pace, and I don't pretend to know all of you, but let me just sort of ask, are there more than one brand name generic alternatives that people might choose in these kind of drugs?
It's a good question, and there's actually a limited number of anti-hemophilia products out there on the market. I'd say there's about, there's less than 12, there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 to 10 different products that are currently out there to treat hemophilia. And just to give you an example of why this is so important to our community to have this exemption from prior authorization is that if somebody's in a situation where they need access to that medication, even though it may be a short period of time to get that type of prior authorization, it could be enough time where it could impact their health or their treatment. And in the case of a number of hours or even, I suppose, up to a day, that could be detrimental to the person that's seeking that type of treatment. And I'm not sure if people on the committee are aware of this, but a number of years back in 99-2000, there was actually a shortage, a national shortage of hemophilia factor blood clotting products.
Mr. Pace, is there a generic version available that might be as effective or near as effective for lower price, or for that matter, among the brands?
Not that I'm aware of. And, you know, just to give you some background on these particular products is that they're highly produced. This isn't just a typical kind of drug treatment product. Each one of these products goes through an incredibly involved process of manufacturing and cleansing, and a lot of this has to do with the suffering that our community experienced back in the 1980s with the HIV infections into the blood supply, and really as a result of the work of much of the work from the hemophilia community, these products are very safe and very clean, and many of them are known as recombinant products, if you will, and free from any type of human infection or carrying of disease. So to answer your question kind of a roundabout way, I'm not aware of any generic equivalents, but the products that are out there, they are in fact expensive. We're not going to disagree with that, but the importance to our community is just immeasurable.
Mr. Pace, among them, the brand names, are there any differences in price, significant differences in price?
You know, in terms of price, there is some variation, but it depends on what type of hemophilia a patient has. So, for example, there are products that are out there to specifically treat a hemophilia A case. There are products out there that are specifically designed to treat a hemophilia B case. There's also the issue of inhibitors. There are patients that don't respond. Their bodies just don't respond to a typical hemophilia blood clotting factor product, and there is one product available for that type of patient with an inhibitor, and so easy access to that product for that patient is absolutely critical. So again, we go back to the issue of access to that product, which is so important to the health of our community. And again, we see this as something separate from the cost, the efforts to contain costs, which we absolutely want to work closely with the state on.
No, thank you. And if I understand from the department's point of view, at least at this point we don't have any scoring, and I think the department is of the mind that probably would not apply the prioritization. Is there any indication from the department? Is that correct? I see a head nodding yes. So,
Mr.
Chair? Yes.
I did a little research. There was a question raised earlier today about these rewards and so on. I think it was 2004. There was a piece of legislation passed. I can't remember what House Bill 2207. I don't remember what bill that was. But it says that no benefit, reward, remuneration, or incentive for continued product use may be provided to an individual or an individual's family by a pharmaceutical manufacturer, medical supplier, device manufacturer, or pharmacy benefit manager, except as there's, and it goes on. And I believe that's what it was meant to contain any issues that were about.
Appreciate that. Any further questions or questions from members? Thank you very much. I know you went above and beyond, but at least for me it was helpful to get a little more background. Thank you, Mike.
Thank you very much.
We're looking forward to working with you as we continue on. Representative Avery renews his motion that House File 855 be held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Health Bill.
Thank you, Mr. President.
If it's tied a diary on, we can just hold off. We're trying to check out our availability. Representative Emmer's our final bill tonight, and I would like to get it done if we can. But if we can get a read on what his situation will be, we'll decide in a moment. So hang loose for a moment. Are you ready to present his bill? I have an idea. Well, let's find out if he's going to be available. I was going to suggest that we could actually have the department come forward and explain the bill, but if Representative Member is not going to be here, it's been done before when the committee's acted on a bill without the author being there, so it's possible for us to do it. Is there someone here from the department that feels comfortable in doing the bill. Why don't you go ahead and come forward, and we'll see if we can do this. I know it's happened to me. I missed an appointment once, and they passed it without me, and probably a better thing to happen. with that, I'll move the House File 1816 be recommended to pass. And let's see. I believe when we do an amendment to strip out the items that are in the budget bill, then it'll be just policy we can move to the floor with. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So the motion will be that House File 1816 be recommended to pass and be referred to the General Register. Now, I believe we have an amendment H1816A3, and I'm not going to try to go through all, but I believe what this does then is strip the language, as staff are nodding yes, that we're stripping the language here that would remove those things that, if you remember, House File 1422, the Omnibus Finance Bill, we had an amendment and it added sections, the mental health sections. So this would just simply strike those, so that then the bill would be strictly and only policy matters. Representative Emily, you did a wonderful job so far. You want to keep doing this as an amendment? We're moving Amendment A3. Would you like to make that motion?
I would, Mr. Chairman, and I'm just reminded constantly of how insignificant and unimportant I truly am. Thank you.
Representative Emily, I don't agree with you at all. You are significant and important. Remember that. This amendment moves adoption of Amendment A3. All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. President Member, I think we now have the bill in its policy form. To your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, this is an agency bill. I'm going to turn it over to the folks that know it intimately, and I will be here to answer questions since I have read it, and it's another very interesting topic. But with that, they'll explain the policy change or the statutory considerations. Thank you.
Okay. Well, who'd like to be here? Ms. Audio?
My name is Sharon Audio. I'm the Director of Adult Mental Health with the Department of Human Services. And I would like to cover the areas that apply either just to adult mental health services or impact both adults and children. So on page 1, line 19, what we're asking is we had a bill that passed 2 years ago to look at standards for integrated dual diagnosis treatment for people with mental health and substance abuse. And we need to develop standards. We're working with the Board of Behavioral Health and our chemical health partners to establish criteria. So we're asking for an extension of 2 years to the language that was passed 2 years ago. On page 5 of the bill, we are asking for a minor change to language that we currently have that allows us to establish contracts, medical assistance contracts with community-based hospitals for up to 45 days of hospitalization. And we found these contracts have been very effective in having people served in their home community. There are rare instances in which an individual person, either because their discharge plan has fell apart or we really are having some issues with medication, the appropriate amount of medication, the people need beyond the 45 days. It's very rare. The average length of stay in these contract beds are 28 days, so we anticipate that this will be budget neutral and that it will only occur in very rare instances, but rather than have the individual leave the hospital after 45 days and go to a state facility, we felt that would be more beneficial and a better treatment approach. On page 6 of the bill, at the bottom, subdivision 4A, several years ago, the legislature passed language that allowed us to do crisis response services for adults. And in developing the criteria that was in the bill, what we found is that it's perhaps too restrictive and too onerous for people, most particularly in rural parts of the state. It required a 24/7 mobile team. And I think what we're asking is to develop some alternative language that will allow counties at the local level to submit information to us regarding how they would expand their crisis services but not needing to have 24/7 capability. On page 16, line 22, what that does is we are requesting a repeal of two legislative reports. One was the civil commitment report that was requested in 01. And what we've found in working with the counties is that they're unable to quantify which civil commitments, and it really is not feasible for us to move forward with that report. The second report is a mental health systems report that we requested and worked with the advocates on following the 02 session, and it was in part concerned that although there was a lot of things that happened with mental health, we did not want mental health to get lost in the process. However, there's been a number of things that have developed since then, the Mental Health Action Group, which I believe you've heard about. That's a public-private partnership, and they're really addressing a number of issues in that report. We've developed, and they've developed some papers regarding that. The State Mental Health Advisory Council, in addition, is required to submit biannually reports on mental health, and we feel that both of those have covered this issue. We have met with the advocates. They're comfortable with us repealing this particular report. And I will now turn it over to Venice Edwald, who is the Director of Children's Mental Health.
Mr. Chairman, Glennis and I were just talking. Now that the budget issues have been taken out, the rest of the information, if you've read the bill, has to do with the juvenile issues and adjudication issues towards the end of the bill, so they're probably going to be more appropriately taken up in civil law.
Which I'm going to have to modify a motion. I moved it for moving this to the general register, and I'll have to go to civil law on next, right?
See, it was important that I was here.
Absolutely. So you're important after all.
I make a difference. With that,
are you suggesting that entire section is really the material for the civil law committee?
Well, I believe it is. Now, Glennis may want to offer something more.
Well, maybe at least we can have, as long as you're here and you've taken the time to be here, maybe just give us a kind of a quick overview. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Chairman. Glennis said, well, I'm Director of the Children's Mental Health Division at the Minnesota Department of Human Services. Article 2 of the Mental Health Bill, very simply, well, not very simply, but makes several changes in juvenile court procedures surrounding placement of children in foster care when those placements are solely for the purpose of gaining access to treatment for children diagnosed with severe emotional disturbance. These changes we felt were necessary because of considerable confusion and a great deal of distress for families who were being served CHIPS petitions and were told that they needed to give up custody of their children in order for those children to be served in residential treatment facilities. And so we have clarified what provisions are actually necessary in order to be in compliance with federal Title IV-E regulations and where we have flexibility to create policy and practice around voluntary placements and the avoidance of filing CHIPS petitions on families in this situation.
Ms. Enwell, just to be sure, I believe this is all policy. There's no requirement, none of the services where it might increase medical assistance or anything like that?
No.
It's all policy?
No, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And although I don't see many people here to do that, but are you aware of any concern or opposition from any groups?
No, we are not.
Okay.
Well, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, they did have one from me on page 3, line 24.
Yeah. That's back in Article 1, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I thought we were talking about Article 2.
I want to do a scuffle of the whole bill. What's in November?
Yeah, and very quickly, they've been wonderful about addressing it. At lines 23 through 25, I've had a major...
What page again?
Page 3.
Is that not stricken, though? We just amended that out, I think.
Oh, is this part of the budget?
Yes, well, it is.
Then,
you may want to,
in the words of Gilda Radner, never mind.
Well, although if you have a concern, that language is in the omnibus bill right now, so as that proceeds, I think you and I need to talk. So,
Mr. Chairman, it just had to do with the vague term using or phrase using a tool approved, and they've assured me that we're going to get some more definition to what that might be. Because my issue was people reading this should have notice of what's going to be expected, and then they should know how they need to deal with that.
So, Department, you mean taking this under advisement now, and we come back with a solution? So, I guess let us know so that we can make that change to the omnibus bill when we bring it back. Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, there's one last piece of policy that is on page 34 of the bill. And what we are proposing or asking is that we add, it's line one and two, that we add an advanced practice registered nurse, which are the nurse practitioners, to the list of people who are able to serve in the role of examiners and health officers under the Commitment Act. During the last session, we added advanced practice nurses who are certified in psychiatric mental health nursing to the list of mental health professionals, and this is now including them under that category. Clinical nurse specialists currently can perform this function, so it's adding another nursing category.
And Ms. Audio, is that what the reference to section 148.171 subdivision 3 is, that the psychiatric?
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's it.
Okay. Well, thank you for bringing that to our attention. Now, I guess in total, Mark, because I think before there might have been some confusion, you're not aware of any opposition, all groups that would be involved now with what remains in this, and we have no opposition that you're aware of? Okay. Is there anyone here in the audience that wishes to testify regarding this bill? I'll come back to it. Seeing no one, Representative Trumba.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is are parents always forced to have their children in foster care in order to get mental health for their children?
Senator?
Representative Tremba and Chairman Bradley. No, not at all. The practice arises around circumstances where a county would be asked to place the child in residential treatment, and in seeking 4E reimbursement for part of that placement, have sometimes thought that they had to proceed with this this particular route. It doesn't appear to be necessary under federal law, and so we simply want to change the practice. But no, most mental health services require no such process.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Further discussion? Representative Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Now it goes. I was just looking on page 35, and I know we've been talking about using the word disability instead of retardation. Would that also be included in here? And that's on line 14.
I wonder if staff could help us with that. There is another bill moving through, and I believe it's an all-encompassing kind of bill. What would happen? Would that bill take care of changing this, or do we need to try to deal with that now? I believe Representative Opatz has that bill. Tom, you know?
Yeah, I'm not, I guess, directly familiar with the bill, but I believe that you are correct that it does cover all areas. It is all-encompassing.
Okay. I think Representative Sanderson might have to take care of it. Maybe if staff would verify, if it's necessary, that could be caught in civil law to change it. But I sort of hesitate for us dabbling in that, since there's a more comprehensive bill that's going to take care of it across all our statutes. Is that Representative Sanderson fair? Okay, thank you. With that, Senator Ember renews his motion. No, we'll have to change the motion, actually, because it was a different motion made previously by me. Representative Ember would move that House File 1816, as amended, we recommend to pass and refer to the Committee on Civil Law. You understand that motion? All those in favor say aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Ember, for taking it. And thank you for testifiers. Well, I believe that does our business for tonight. We have a meeting again 10:15 tomorrow. We're done.